Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we meet women who influence us to be inspired as we hear their life stories and think more about our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Nina Mishkoff. Hello and welcome, Nina.
Hello, Nikki, and thank you for asking me.
Pleasure. And did I pronounce your name right?
Absolutely perfect. I've lived with so many variations, I honestly couldn't care less.
Did you say it was Polish?
It's Polish, and my father was Polish. That's where that came from.
Well, that's amazing. So Nina Mishkoff is a Scottish journalist. Is that right?
Scottish? No, I'm not Scottish. Well, technically, I was born in Scotland, and then I went back and lived in Scotland later. But I don't count myself as Scottish. I don't count myself as Polish. I was brought up in South Africa, and I don't count myself South African. I am a Londoner. That's where I've chosen to live, and that's the only thing I care about.
There we go, then. So Nina Mishkoff is a Londoner journalist and the very first female editor of the well-known teen magazine Jackie, and appeared as a TV personality on New Faces. She was a pop columnist for The Sun and TV critic for the News of the World under the byline The Bitch on the Box, and a contributor on Grumpy Old Women. Now, Nina, surely you wouldn't count yourself as either of those.
What? Technically, no, because my byline, I'm being really picky now, my byline on the News of the World was never Bitch on the Box. That was somebody else entirely different on the Star. I had the TV critic with Bite, which made me sound like Dracula, or Britain's Wittiest TV Critic, which anybody could argue with. But that was never my... That was never my byline, and people just took it from something and sort of flung it at me, and I've had to live with that, but that's fine. Grumpy Old Women, I'd argue with that too, because I've been grumpy all my life. And why, it's not just now that I get cross about things.
Why change that now? I don't believe you at all. I don't believe you at all. Well, I'm sorry, but I think I took that straight from Wikipedia. So it's them that we need to get onto about that title, isn't
Absolutely. It? Absolutely. It's certainly, I would never claim Bitch on the Box. And it actually has always rather annoyed me because, you know, men are forthright and positive and women are bitches. And I object to that.
Quite rightly so. Honestly, well, they haven't got a good word to say about us. So you're none of those things. You're very lovely and very friendly. And here we are meeting for the first time. Now, you mentioned that you grew up in South Africa, but you even speak Afrikaans. Have I pronounced that right?
Ek het bijna alles van mijn Afrikaans vergeet, which means I've forgotten nearly all of it. My parents emigrated to South Africa when I was about 18 months old. My father had arrived from Poland with the Polish forces, I think it was about 3 days after Dunkirk, apparently, and then he was stationed in the eastern part of Scotland, in Fife, and he was billeted, like all the Polish officers were, with families in the little villages there, and he was billeted with two elderly spinsters, and who I think sort of really adored him, and the Polish forces cut a swathe through the Scots countryside, I think, because they were in their uniform, and there was a lot of heel clicking and dashing sort of hand kissing that went on. And he met my mother, who was a first year student at Dundee University, which was a college of St Andrews University in those days, and she was studying science. And the students were all asked to take one Polish officer and teach them English. So she was matched up with my father, and she came from a sort of farming family, and the farm was sort of in the sort of the countryside behind this little village, and the only way she could get from the farm to this house where the spinsters lived and, you know, pampered my father-to-be, was by borrowing a man's bicycle, which had no brakes. So when she'd pedal furiously around there to teach him English, and then she had no brakes, so she'd have to fall off into the hedge round the corner in case he saw her. Yeah. Anyway, very long-winded story to say. But anyway, they got married at the end of the war, and I was born. My father knew he couldn't go back to Poland because the Allies had drawn a line, and his part of south eastern Poland no longer existed. It was, I think, it sort of became Ukraine, and the family lands were gone. And I think my grandfather was kind of dumped over the line by the Allies. And existed, I think, for a year in a cellar eating mushrooms that he grew. So that he knew he couldn't go back. There was nothing to go back for. He did a degree in forestry, which is a degree he'd done in Poland. But my mother taught him English so well that he did this degree in English in forestry, and knew he had to go somewhere with a big forest. So applied to the colonies, and as they were then known, and it was Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and South Africa came up first, and it was the best deal. So off we went, and that's why I was brought up in South Africa, and. Until I was 15, and then things changed rapidly then.
And then you became a Londoner. What a fabulous story. Gosh, I can visualise that. As you said it, that wonderful picture that you painted for us of your lovely family. Now, we're going to talk about you now. You started your career on the legendary influential teenage magazine, Jackie, and actually became the very first female editor. Now, some women of a certain age out there, myself included, will fondly remember that magazine with posters all over the bedroom wall and problem pages way before the internet and social media and letters in. How did that come about?
Well, I went to St Andrews University for a year and then decided, look, I want to get on with things. But I was living in this little village across the river from Dundee with my mother and my brother. And I thought, gosh, and I rang up the Scotsman in Edinburgh and I thought, you know, can I come and work for you? Can I just learn? And they said, well, you're so close to Dundee. Why don't you go to DC Thompson's? They're the largest private publishing firm in Europe. They have everything, 30, 40 different publications from the Beano to the Dandy. Go and talk to them. So I rang up and went and said, can I come and talk to you about perhaps, you know, a career in journalism? And I spent a day there being sort of passed from editor to editor. And at the end of the day, they said to me, when can you start? And I said, well, I don't know. I wanted to start. I'm not doing anything on Monday, so I'll turn up if that's all right. And that's what I did. And so I was then there for 12 years. So I started on Jackie and immediately started doing the reader's letter page, not the problem page, you know, the ones where they'd write in and say, my cat did this funny thing last week, you know, that sort of thing, really sweet. But then gradually did every sort of different job on the magazine and loved it. And so because music and show business were the things that I really loved, that's the pop music thing is what I gravitated to.
Oh, it was fabulous. We all loved that magazine. I mean, who are your heroes? I mean, David Essex, you obviously met him. Who else was around? Starsky and Hutch, Donny Osmond or David Cassidy? Who was yours?
Well, the thing is, I was older than the readers. I mean, obviously I was older than the readers. I was in my 20s, so I didn't have a teenage crush like that because I could understand completely why they fell for Donny Osmond's gorgeous puppy eyes and cute face, or David Cassidy's beautiful, beautiful face and his cute little bottom and prancing around on stage in a white, you know, Elvis-type jumpsuit. Otherwise, if I hadn't understood that, I wouldn't have been able to pick the right pin-ups for the readers to put on their walls. But they weren't my crushes. I mean, David Essex I met and loved him dear, and his beautiful blue eyes, most gorgeous blue eyes. But he had a manager who really looked after him really well and who'd sent me a wonderful photograph of David to use as a double page pin-up. And when we printed it, he rang me out and shouted at me. And I said, why? He said, David's eyes are bluer than that. Your printing's crap.
Oh, no.
And he was quite right, actually.
So who was your pin-up then?
My pin-up, do you know, I quite fancied Elvis. And the first pop star I ever saw was Cliff Richard. Bizarrely, he came to South Africa. So when I was 12, I think, I saw Cliff Richard performing in Durban. And it was hilarious because I remember going to see, you know, my friend's mum drove us down there and me and my best friend Leslie, and we sat there and the girls around us were all screaming, 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 and the curtain hadn't even gone up. And I thought, I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm going to be sensible and calm and cool, and he's going to notice me because I'm the only one that's not screaming. And the curtain sort of started rising up. It was one of those ones that didn't go back sideways. It went up vertically. And so it got to his shoes. And people, the noise was deafening. By the time it got to his knees, I was screaming.
So it didn't work then.
No,
actually, didn't. I did take my daughter to a Justin Bieber concert the other year, and it was very similar.
It's always it's the same. It's the same from generation to generation. I can completely, I mean, I've sat there and been deafened at Bay City Rollers concerts or Osmond's concerts. And I have to tell you, the Osmond's concerts were a damn sight more professional, fabulous entertainment compared to the Bay City Rollers, who pranced around in those stupid half-mast trousers. And I just couldn't. When it got to the Bay City Rollers, I thought, I just don't understand this. And I thought, time to get out.
Donny was my favourite.
Oh,
I never saw the...
He's adorable. He's a lovely, lovely man. I've kept up with him down the years. I haven't seen him for a couple of years, but he is just adorable. He's totally professional, very warm, very witty, very wise, very self-deprecating, and constantly reinvents himself. He is admirable and great fun.
We'll have lunch with Donny next time, is he?
I'm up for that.
There was a Jackie stage musical as well, and you were editor-in-chief of that.
Well, this is the strangest thing. I mean, you know, that Jackie was the start of my career, and, you know, it's a long time ago. It's 50 years ago. And a couple of years ago, a producer rang me up, and he'd been put in touch with me by a man called John Reed, who was Elton's manager and Queen's manager. And I had recently bumped into him, and he put me in touch with this producer who was making a musical out of Jackie. And I thought, well, how on earth can you do that? Who wants to see girls on stage with a typewriter? You know, that's or what? How's it going to be? And it was absolutely brilliant. It was a terrific storyline. It was about a woman of middle years who'd been dumped by her husband, was in the process of divorce, was clearing the house up, and comes back from the wine bar with her best friend, slightly squiffy, and trips over a box. And inside the box is not only her old maths jotter, but her old bunch of 70s Jackie magazines. And she immediately goes back in time to that era mentally. So she's got her younger self talking to her, and you just go through the story of what happens to her. She meets somebody else. You got the story of the ex-husband and the horrible young girlfriend. You got the young son whom she wants to go to college, but he just wants to be in a band. And you really care about what happens to her. And it was such an empowering evening. Anyway, so they put this musical together. It said to me, be the editor-in-chief, which was just a silly made-up title. You know, so I was kind of like the sort of the mentor, consultant, cheerleader. And it was fabulous. And it was a couple of years ago, and it toured Britain for 6 months to completely sell out houses. And it was one of the most uplifting evenings you could go to, because it was fantastic 70s music, 23 people on stage and a band. And everything you've ever wanted, you know, hopes, tears, laughter, fears. And it just for me to sit there on so many evenings, I never got bored with it, and look out at the audience having such a wonderful time recapturing their youth, that time in their teens, which is the most sort of evocative time, the most that meant most to them somehow. You know, it's the most influential time of their lives. To think, these were my readers.
They were
my readers, and I and all the hopes that I had for them, that I really had for them when I was editor, I just wish they'd come true. I wanted them to be young women who could make a choice in life, because in those days in the 70s, it, you know, you mostly when you were educated and you might go to university, but generally it was thought that you'd then get married and have children. You might go back to work later, but that wasn't the important thing. And because my mother was a school teacher and had worked, I was very very concerned that people should be able to see a far horizon and go for it, and to think that they could achieve something rather than just be somehow dwindle into marriage. And although the magazine was about fun and entertainment, that's what a magazine should be, and pop and fashion and music and boys and makeup and picture love stories and all of that, I hoped, not just with the Cathy and Claire problem page, but with other articles, that this could reinforce my ideas. And so hopefully it wasn't just a frivolous thing, which I hoped it would be, and fun, but that there was a sort of, there was a message. Definitely. There was definitely a message that they could get, and they could feel part of something.
Interesting. So you were empowering females ahead of your time there.
Well, I hope so. I mean, if I had any influence at all, that's the time I'd be proud of it. I mean, since then, I wouldn't say that I've looked to be influential in any way at all. But in those days, and I think perhaps not so much at the beginning, but as I moved upwards, and then when I became editor, I thought more deeply about it. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to try and help in some way, to try and give women, young women, a sort of sense of themselves and of self-esteem and self-worth, because it seemed to be really important.
Definitely, and still so topical now. That's really interesting. Thank you. You've been on television both as a panellist on Through the Keyhole and on New Faces. Now, was New Faces a pre-originator for X Factor and the Pop Idol and all of these? I mean, what were you doing with it? Were you singing and dancing?
No. I was a judge on New Faces in the 80s. I have to tell you that when I first met Simon Cowell, probably about 20 years ago, he walked into the office where I was, and he went on his knees and he went, "I am not worthy. I am not worthy. I am not worthy." And I looked down at him and I said, "No, you're not. Get up."
Brilliant. I've never seen him brought to his knees.
No. Well, there, but it's a very long time ago. But no, I was a judge on New Faces, and it was a Saturday night talent show. I suppose more like Britain's Got Talent, because it was a variety. It wasn't just singing by any means. And it ran for 3 series. And I had great fun with it, because the presenter was a lovely woman called Marty Kane. And we became great friends, great mates, the two of us. And sadly, she died too early. And I still miss her. But no, that was great fun. I loved that.
You've got some wonderful stories and wonderful, rich experiences you've had that everyone can learn from. I love that.
I got the gig because I was at that point TV. I'd started on Jackie, then moved to The Sun and became the rock writer on The Sun. But I was known as the Queen of Pop and travelled the world interviewing rock stars. I went to China with Jean-Michel Jarre. I went to South America with Queen at Freddie Mercury's invitation. I met David Bowie. And he bought me champagne on my birthday. He actually was playing in Dundee, and he came. There was only the one hotel in Dundee where people would gather afterwards, and he came there, and I went to interview him, and he was with, you know, all the sort of the entourage, etc. And he was running, and he discovered it was going to be my birthday at midnight, so he bought me a bottle of champagne, and I said, "That's very kind of you, but what I'd really like is an interview." He said, "Well, come back tomorrow morning." Fine, before I check out, and that's exactly what I did. But to my horror, looking back, I can't believe I said to him at some point, and because I'd never seen a man wearing makeup before. I mean, you just didn't see it. It was, you know, early 70s. And I actually said to him, "David, I do think if a male man is going to be wearing nail varnish, it should at least not be chipped." to his credit, he laughed like a drain.
You've met some amazing legends. Did you interview Freddie as well?
Yes, absolutely. That's how I came to go to South America. Freddie was very shy. He had a very foreboding look if he didn't know who you were, and quite sort of daunting. And I'd been at a dinner where he'd sat across the table, and I thought, "Oh my God, he just doesn't. Oh, I feel like a piece of, you know, dirt under the shoe, really." But anyway, I came to interview him, and sat, you know, quite trepidatious, and sat down next to him, and we got on so well that when after an hour the PA sort of stuck her head round the door and said, "Everything okay, Freddie?" And that would be the chance to sort of usher me out. He said, don't go away, darling. Don't be so boring. Just bring a bottle of wine." And we downed 2 bottles of wine, I think. And then he said, "Darling, you have to come to South America." And I said, "Well, of course I must." So off I went. And we went to Buenos Aires and then to Rio. And it was absolutely fantastic. It was the most extraordinary experience. When we got there, and there was, I think, a dozen journalists from around the world, he absolutely refused to speak to anybody else. He wouldn't be interviewed. The others had to do the interviews, but he refused to be interviewed. And they said, "Look, Freddie, you have to do it." He said, "I'll only do it if she sits in with me."
Isn't that interesting? Gosh, just like the Star is Born movie. Yeah, and actually, hilarious. You went to the launch of Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie, just recently, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Absolutely. It was an extraordinary event. It was was up at Wembley. I mean, but 7,000, so not exactly exclusive, but it was amazing to see a depiction of somebody that I had known. It was very. I found the end of it very, very moving. That sort of recreation of Live Aid, where Freddie was just the king of the world, and Queen had been out of favour for years before that somehow, and yet that on that Live Aid day it was just fantastic. So to see that recreated, and then to see, you know, to know that he died so young, that it was somehow very, very moving. Live Aid was fantastic, by the way. I sat next to Kenneth Branagh, of all things, of all people. We both had just one ticket, you know, so that's what happened to be sitting next to him.
You've met the best people, and you're a lovely person yourself. Now, you've also reviewed newspapers on This Morning TV and contributed to The Alan Titchmarsh Show, Daybreak, Pointless, and The Michael Ball Show. And in fact, you've got a Pointless trophy, haven't you?
I've got a Pointless trophy. I'm so thrilled. God, that show's hard. It really is. I mean, because you can't mug up for it. You either know things or you don't. I was just delighted to win. I went on a second time and got knocked out in the round before. So I'm obviously on the slide.
You did well, though. You've got a trophy. But a trophy, how can they call a trophy a Pointless trophy? That doesn't seem fair.
Well, Pointless celebrities, much more to the point.
Not at all. Now, more recently, you appeared on Big Brother and the spin-off show. I mean, what was it like in that reality environment?
My appearance on Big Brother came about because I was on the spin-off show, you know, with Rylan, and it was with Emma as well in those days. But what they asked me to do was to go on into the actual house one afternoon and give them, they were about to come out, and it was just the week before the final, and to give them all media training. So that was hilarious, to go into the actual house. I mean, it was terribly smelly, I have to say. And, you know, they were so desperate to see other people. It was quite touching. It was really... It wasn't a celebrity one. It was a civilian one, as it were. No, but that was absolutely fascinating.
And you stayed the night?
No. I just was there for a couple of hours.
So you didn't have that intense, locked-in feeling?
God, no. No, that would have been hideous. Very claustrophobic and smelly, I expect.
Which strong men or women have inspired you then? I mean, you've met so many incredible people.
The creator and the first editor of Jackie magazine, nobody knows about him. He was a red-headed Scotsman called Gordon Small. And he was the one who employed me, and I worked for him happily for 12 years. And he taught me everything there was to know about journalism. If he, as a gruff Scot who'd come out of the, I think the army or the air force or something, because he was of the era where you did national service, which probably people wouldn't even know what that means these days, but you had to go and do your bit, and he created a teenage magazine for girls, you know, aimed at sort of, you know, 11, 10, 11, 12 to 15, and to create immediately a market leader, and to have a magazine which is even now talked about as an iconic magazine. So and for him to do that as this gruff Scotsman, that was some journalistic, you know, gift he had. And so he I admired for that. Personally, I suppose like everybody else, it's my parents. But not necessarily in the same way that you might imagine. My father died when I was 12, which was devastating to me, and that coloured my life. That really coloured my life, to lose your father when you're just about to embark on life as a teenager is a very hard thing. And it meant that my mother, I felt sorry for my mother, because she was then widowed with a 12-year-old daughter and a four-year-old son, and fortunately had a profession, went back to teaching, so and then brought us back from South Africa to Scotland, where she was from, when I was 15, because South Africa was about to become a republic, and she was supposed to, you know, everybody said it's going to be a bloodbath, so she brought me back to live with her family in Scotland, which I absolutely hated. I loathed it. So when you asked me, are you Scottish? I said, no, I'm not. I don't dislike Scotland at all as a country, and I love the people, but that is not me. And I'd come from a country of wide open spaces and blue skies, and to be in a narrow, cold, grey, weather, grey buildings, and it seemed to me grey mines. I felt completely cut off and destroyed. And my mother and I had never had a good relationship, particularly. My mother wasn't a sort of cuddly mum and not fantastically supportive. But I felt sorry for her. So, which is not meant to sound condescending at all, but I felt deeply that she had lost my father. And so I tried to do my best with her and for her and to help her with my brother. And those two things shaped me enormously. So I wanted to escape, ultimately. And so I probably stayed in Scotland longer than I might have done, but I stayed for my mother's sake and for my, not for my brother particularly, because he was then growing up and he was fine. But then I got a chance to leave Scotland, to leave DC Thompson's, to leave Jackie and to start On the Sun in London. And I made my escape. And when I was a teenager in Scotland, it was just, it was such a miserable time. You know, looking back on it, I, you know, the teenagers, hopefully, who read Jackie, must have had all sorts of lives. And I hope they had happy lives. But I had a miserable teenage time. I mean, from the moment my teenage years started with the death of my father and then being taken to Scotland and loathing it. I used to get Honey magazine, which was a monthly magazine. And that was, oh, that was the key to, oh, look, there are people, it's colourful, it's life, it's the sort of life I'd much rather lead. And I remember watching on television, there was a soap called Compact, which was about a magazine, a woman's magazine, and how frivolous to base your life on that. But I thought, oh, that looks like something. And those two things were key to me. And that's why I knew I wanted to go into magazines or journalism. That's how that happened.
Isn't that interesting, though, that actually that all of that shaped you and your career? And I'm so sorry to hear about your dad and that loss. But that loss that took you to Scotland gave you that joy, that job of joining Jackie, that then helped all those others suffering in their teenage years like you did.
Yes, absolutely. And it, you know, staying in South Africa, having a happy, sunny time, I might never have ever done anything like that. There wouldn't have been the scope to do that. So everything's meant for a reason, you know, and life is a circle. And I realised that all that unhappiness actually became a positive thing for me eventually, which I think is really important for people to know, that if they are going through terrible times or, you know, the worst thing is when things happen to you and you have no control over them and you think, oh, my God. But if you just take a step back and then move forward, you know, things work out for the best.
But your mum must have been proud of you at Jackie magazine.
Not really. Not that she ever said. She thought, I don't know why you're bothering with such silly pop rubbish. She always wanted me to be a teacher like her. You're completely wasted on that, she'd always say. She was a very critical woman. She never really was that sort of woman who was encouraging in that sort of way. Or in terms of, you know, gosh, you look nice in that, or shall I, you know, that wasn't her at all. She was a science teacher. She was a very logical woman. And she felt, I think, that life had dealt her a really hard deal and a bad blow with my father dying. So she never really recovered from that. She did recover to a certain extent, but she never really felt that she had happiness much after that.
Bless you. Well, she was no nonsense for her reasons, wasn't she?
Yes,
but I do think you look fabulous in that, so there you go.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I do my best.
What's been the proudest moment of your career or your life then, Nina? I mean, there's been a number of things.
Hopefully still to come.
Ooh.
Still to come. I always look forward. Looking back, I think I am proud of Jackie. I really am proud that I became the first female editor, because it meant that all the women in the company, and there were thousands of women working in DC Thompson's, and every single publication was edited by a man.
This was in the 60s, wasn't it?
This was in the 70s. Yes, the 60s. When I became editor in 1974. So I started there in 66. As people did stay in jobs a long time then. You know, not necessarily for life, but a lot of people did. But, you know, we don't sort of move from one thing to the other. That was something I was proud of, because a lot of the women came to me and said, thank you so much, because you've you've broken through. And it makes
you did. You smashed that glass ceiling, girl.
I did, and I was proud of that. Then I became entirely frivolous and lived absolutely for myself. And as I say, I was then the rock writer on The Sun. But I'm proud of the stories I did, and in terms of the people I met. I met Elton John when he was 20 and I was 21, and he'd only been called Elton for 6 months. So, you know, I was proud of years later doing his wedding, and then his divorce. Getting those exclusives.
Life is a circle.
Exactly. And I was proud to have done three series of new faces. I think I'm proud that I've adapted down the years.
You've reinvented yourself, girl.
I think I have, because basically through boredom. I mean, I really would get bored if I didn't do something new. That's why I love it. But what I love about it, the whole journalistic thing, because basically I'm a journalist. The fact that it's allowed me to indulge my passion, which is love and admire talent. It's talent, musical talent, or writing talent, or acting talent. And my what I laughingly call my career, has allowed me to have conversations with these people. I wouldn't claim friendship with many of them, get to know them and see them again, maybe. And it's lovely because now I'm seeing people again that I haven't seen for years, people like Roger Daltrey or Brian May of Queen. I haven't seen them for decades and I'm seeing them again now. And I'm proud that I've managed to somehow finagle a career out of it.
And that's a good word as well. What was that again?
Finagle. I don't know where that came from.
From the depths of
somewhere.
That's journalism. I like that. I like that. Now, well, you talked about your passions and your passion for talent. Now, I wanted to ask you about your passions, but the title on the book of your life that I was going to say you need to write a book on your life, but you've done an autobiography, was entitled Love, Sex and the Pursuit of Chocolate. Now, would you like to share any of those things?
Well, I have to tell you first that I didn't actually write that. It was my autobiography was ghostwritten. How lazy is that? How lazy is that? I much prefer talking to writing, and if I can get away with it, I will.
But what was your favourite out of those?
I have to say, well, at various times in my life, love, love always, love, love always. Sex comes and goes, you know, and depending on your age, but love is a constant. I mean, it would be more flippant to say chocolate's a constant, but love, really.
Now, what are your other hobbies, and what else are you passionate about?
I am passionate about anything to do with entertainment. I know that sounds, I'm still on the same hobby horse, really. I love music. I wish I'd kept up my piano lessons, which I had when I was young. I got to grade six, did my exams and things. I really adored the piano. And then when my mother, when I was 15, when my mother proposed that she was going to take me and my brother back to Scotland, I tried everything to prevent her. And I said, I'm not going without the cat and the dog. And she came back the next day and said, well, we're taking them with us. And the next day I said, I shall never play the... Look, dramatic teenager. I will never play the piano again. And she said, don't. And I never did.
Well, you need to take it up again.
Well, I should do that. I really should. It's really... I mean, that's how stupid I was. I mean, how idiotic you are when you're young, aren't you?
It's all to try and make something happen that you would like to happen.
Absolutely. So the piano I should take up again. I've been learning French in evening classes, which I really enjoyed that. I used to love baking, but I don't bake because I just eat it. Do you know what I mean? I would happily spend my life baking and playing the piano.
Go and meet Elton again and ask him for some piano lessons.
Elton would be perfect to give me piano lessons. I mean, my absolutely one regret in life is that I didn't take somebody up on their offer. And this was possibly in the late 60s. I had met Elton, as I told you, when he was 20 and 21. And I'd met him in a little recording studio on Oxford Street. By chance, Elton John had that morning written a song called Nina. By complete serendipitous chance. So we hit it off and we went round the corner to in Denmark Street to have a coffee and chatted and laughed. He did his array of voices. He's a very good impressionist. He did Dame Edith Evans saying a handbag. And I was then working from Dundee. And when I went back there, we corresponded. So he said, you know, when you're next in London, we'll have another cup of coffee. And we did that. And he then wrote to me and said, I've got my first album coming out. When you come, we'll go to lunch, because he's obviously had the money to take me to lunch. And we went to lunch. It was at the same cafe, I have to say. And he brought the album and he inscribed it to me. And I was thrilled to be out of Scotland. I mean, I was still trying to escape. So after about 10 minutes of, you know, thrilled to see you and blah, 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 we both sort of dwindled a bit. And he said to me, what's wrong? And I said, I've only got to get out of Scotland and come and live in London, but I don't know how to do that, you know. I don't know how to get another job. And I said, what's wrong with you? He said, well, you know, I don't think I can write with Bernie Taupin again. You know, Bernie Taupin writes his lyrics. He said, this album, I think it's a flash in the pan. I said, don't be ridiculous. You know, it's just a phase. It'll all work out. And there was a pause and he said to me, ever thought of writing lyrics? And I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. I couldn't write lyrics. And he said, well, have you ever tried? I said, no, why would I try to write lyrics? He said, promise me when you go back to Scotland, you'll write lyrics. Did I, Nikki?
Well, you need to take up your piano and write lyrics. There could be a whole thing out there.
It's a bit late now, I would have thought.
Never too late. What are you talking about?
But can you imagine, you know, if I had, well, you know, there's no supposing that I might have been able to, but you never know. I mean,
this could be your thing.
It could be my thing. It was actually very sweet when he then sent to me at some point, he sent to me a demo of a single. And he said, you were quite right. You know, I'm still writing with Bernie and we do well together. He said, I'm sending you, I've got this single here. I'm sitting at my desk opening. It was a little brown envelope, those padded envelopes. And inside with this demo single, he said, it's just the piano and me, but it'll have, you know, orchestration on it. He said, I, as you know, didn't write the lyrics, but I was thinking of you when I wrote the song. And it was your song.
Isn't that beautiful, really?
Absolutely. So he may well, as a promotion, have sent that to 20 people. I have no idea, or 200. But he sent it to me.
So. That's special, isn't it?
So you see, I have been very lucky. I have been very, very lucky that I've met all these really interesting people.
Gosh, you see, it's a fabulous career. What was that? Whatever that word was that you used earlier. So do you have a mantra for living your life then?
Keep going. I'm also very lucky in that I'm very happily 28 years with a wonderful Australian called Grant. We met when I was at BSB before it became Sky, and I had a show of my own there called Nina versus the Rest, and he was on the front desk. He'd just arrived from Australia and we got together. We are 28 years happily unmarried, and we're both the same. We're both kind of loners. We're both kind of people who are, you know, I think as a journalist you're an outsider in a way because you observe, and we're both loners that got together, and we are a very, very tight unit. We're very happy together, and that's a very, very lucky thing.
So that's beautiful. He lets you be you.
Oh yes, and he's him, but we are very much a strong unit. We are happiest in each other's company, you know. So we love travel, you know, drop of a plane ticket, we're off somewhere. We love that. We love everything about it. We even like going to the airport, even hate going through security, but we love the whole process of travel. We like seeing new things. That's what we like doing. So
can he play the piano?
No, he can't. But he's very musical. We love the same music. We both like opera. We both like ballet. We both like rock music. We are very compatible. We like the same TV programs. I like Bake Off. He likes things about cars, though. That's the difference.
Would it have been different if you had been married?
I don't think so. But it was never an aim of mine. And never a name of his. And I thought maybe one day, you know, years ago when I was in my 20s and thinking, do I want to be married? And I thought, I wouldn't mind a day out in a frock, but not really. It's not been my thing, really.
There's still time.
Well, I don't see the point of it. If it's not broke, why fix it? Do you keep going. And our toast, when we have a glass of Aussie Fizz or something, or whenever, of an evening, is we always drink to surviving in style, because that seems to me the aim in life, isn't it? Surviving in style.
I think you both sound fantastic.
Yes, exactly. Well, the thing is, keep going, which is why I'm very lucky and very happy at the moment. I write. I write for The Times. I've just interviewed Ollie Mers for The Times, and Katie Derham was the last one before that. I make documentaries and appear on Radio 2. I love that. I love radio. And I'm now about to launch a podcast, which I am just, you know, heaven on a stick for me, because it's talking to interesting people. It's talking to celebrities. It's aimed at the over 60s. It's aimed at baby boomers, if you like, and I hope other people will like it. But it's actually the people to qualify, you really have to be over 60. And I've called it Too Late to Die Young. And so it will be people like Glenda Jackson, Dame Sandra Rhodes, Roger Daltrey of The Who, because he sang Hope I Die Before I Get Old, Brian May, Patty Boyd, David Sedaris, the author. Amazing people.
What an amazing lineup. What about Judi Dench, Helen Mirren?
Helen Mirren, I would love to do Helen Mirren. Well, both of them. They're such heroines, aren't they? Oh. I mean, they sum it up, don't they? That baby boomer spirit of, you know, we're that generation where we haven't sort of meekly kind of, you know, been elbowed aside, allowed ourselves to be elbowed aside by the next generation. I mean, we're being a bit, people say we're selfish. I don't think so. We're just keeping going, basically.
Can we interview them together, Helen Mirren, Dame Judi Dench?
Do you know, that would be really interesting, but I much prefer to do people on their own. Oh. I like that. It's just selfish of me to want that momentary relationship that lasts the time of the interview. It'd be a fascinating conversation, I know, but I really, if I were lucky enough, and I can't imagine that I'd be lucky enough to get Judi Dench, I would want her all to myself for that hour.
I'll have her after.
If I can pass her on, then I'd happily do that for you.
They'd be fabulous, wouldn't they? I'd love to meet them. My goodness. You've mentioned, yes, what you're doing now, you've appeared on BBC, ITV, Channel 5, within Saga magazine and The Times. We've talked about your trophy. You're making a series called First Ladies of Fleet Street. You mentioned that, didn't you?
I'm making a series called First Ladies of Fleet Street for Radio 2, and it's in kind of a celebration of the centenary of the beginning of suffrage in this country. Just at a time when the whole media scene is changing and newspapers are dwindling, and it's looking back at how attitudes to women have changed. And, you know, journalism has always been one of those areas where if you can do the job and you're a woman, you're in. And so in a way, journalists were very lucky that we could have a job and have a good job and have the sort of, you know, the sort of fun, professional, hectic, deadline driven, exciting life that men had. But, you know, there's always been attitude. And it's interesting to talk to women who were there in the 70s, like I was, and who joined in the 90s even, to see how attitudes have changed or are changing, and or how much more they still have to change. I think banter is a dreadful word, and I think all of us have had to put up with dreadful banter down the decades, which is just hides a whole load of sexist nonsense. But it's interesting to talk to women and see what they've achieved, and to celebrate them, really. I'm looking forward to the conversations. That's what I'm really looking forward to, because I want to know. I want to know what it's like. It's not all going to be about ageing by any means. You know, it'll be an excuse to allow somebody, say like Roger Daltrey, to look back on the shape, the path that his life has taken, you know, to be able to pass on what life lessons he's learned and talk about any regrets he's had or hilarious times. But also because I want to explore with him what the aging process means. I mean, you know, when he sits down, does he make that little sound, you know, oof sound, like, you know what are his creaks and aches, and, you know, how depressed is he about the end point? Because we're at that stage of life where we're closer to the end than the beginning, and have we faced up to it yet? I mean, I personally really haven't. You know, I put not me not yet as my sudden kind of attitude.
I love that attitude.
Yeah, well, thank you. But, you know, it's just sort of just keeping going. I mean, I'm very lucky. I'm very I work hard at being healthy. I rattle with vitamin pills. I go to the gym every morning. I do, yeah, an hour every morning.
And what do you do in the gym then?
I do a big warm-up on the bike first, then I do stretching, then I do series of weights, and then I do do cardio on the bike again, then I do more stretching.
That's fantastic.
And I walk, I wear a Fitbit, as you can see. I try and do my 10,000 steps a day, at least 70,000 steps a week, so that's, you know, keep going. My mantra, keep going.
You're an advert for us all, I tell you. My goodness. Now, what's your next goal then? It's obviously the podcast.
The next goal is the podcast. So I'm focused on that. But at the same time, I'm, as a freelance journalist, I feel like I'm a Chinese acrobat. I'm always spinning plates, and I don't want to drop any plates because I obviously have to keep my writing going for you know, the odd saga feature, the odd Times feature, and the radio stuff, and the telly as well. I'm spinning plates, and I hope not to drop a plate. But also, because I'm, you know, I work hard, and I enjoy what I do, and I'm, you know, driven by deadlines. But at the same time, I can do absolutely nothing for a great deal of time if I'm travelling. You know, I can sit on a cruise and just look at the sea. I mean, you know, I'd always rattle around museums, and I love seeing new places. So that's another aim, is to travel somewhere else. You know, this year we've managed, we went to Crete for my birthday. We went on a fantastic Mediterranean cruise, which was a travel piece for the Mail on Sunday, and flew to Rome, came back via the west coast of Italy down to Sicily, up to Corfu, and then came back from Dubrovnik. I mean, that to me is that. So, frankly, if I could do a podcast a week and travel, that would do me fine, frankly. So travel. Yeah, and this time last year, we were in Oman. We were in Barbados for Christmas. And all, let me tell you, done with vouchers, travel freebies, airline points, and as inexpensively as we can make it, with, you know. So it's not that I've got bucket loads of money and we just say, oh, you know, darling, let's go first class here. That's not my life. Frankly, I wish it were, but it's not. But I just make it, we make it work somehow. And that to me is an achievement.
It's definitely an achievement, and surviving in style.
Well, yes, what else is there, for heaven's sake?
I'm with you. Fantastic. So, lastly, what key message would you give to inspire and influence women?
I think you have to look outside yourself, and you look at society and look and see where things are out of kilter, are off balance. And despite the Me Too movement and all of that, things haven't changed enough. And for me as a woman, I would hope that young women today can take heart from those who've gone before, and can see that they should stand firm, be independent, be proud of themselves, not take any nonsense from anybody, and apply themselves. I know it sounds really dull, and have a goal in life, and try and achieve that, and to be as happy as possible, and be kind to people. I know it sounds like, you know, I'm sitting like Miss World. You know, what do you want? World peace. And a better bikini. You know, in the wider picture, you'd want, I think the education of women is the most important thing in this world today, because without the education of women in third world countries, the population is going to continue to explode, and it's going to destroy our planet if we don't do that. So for me, the key thing is education of women, which goes back to my Jackie days, but that still is something that people should take on. For men, I think that the Me Too thing has been perhaps a salutary eye-opening. Maybe men don't understand what women have had to go through and still go through, because men have always been the stronger stronger breed, if you like, and take it for granted that things, you know, go their way. So they assume that women are equally as capable, or as balanced, or as doors are as open to them as they are for men, which is not the case. So I'd like men to have a little think about that, and to be kinder, and to be a bit more generous and thoughtful when it comes to women and how they treat them. Basically, I mean, I know this sounds like a load of pompous old twaddle. Basically, Have fun, be kind, and have a laugh.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, and good luck with your podcast and everything else you're doing. You're one busy lady, and you're such an inspiration. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for asking me. You're an inspiration too.
So thank you, Nina, for taking us back down memory lane in our young teen years with your Jackie magazine and your wonderful life stories, and good luck with your podcast. This influential women's podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please keep listening for more podcasts fortnightly to your inbox. These podcasts are hosted on Audioboom, and you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, Castbox, Overcast, Pocket Cast, and Stitcher.